Okay, thank you. Thanks to the COG for continuing to host these. We should also talk about the how long the CROG will graciously extend themselves for the hosting of these meetings and the recording, or whether we should consider some alternatives. But in any case, good morning, everyone. This is the regular monthly meeting of the Advisory Commission on Intergovernmental Relations. I'm Brendan Sharkey, the chair of ACIR. It happens to be April 1st, which means that officially our intrepid vice chair, Lal Ray, is not officially on our among our members. We currently have a vacancy for vice chair, which the governor's office, we hope will fill that appointment within the next next few weeks. So so in light of that, I'll be riding solo without a anyone riding shotgun going forward. But welcome all. Again, this is a Zoom meeting. Therefore, remember the protocols of keeping yourself muted, if you would, unless you want to speak. And if you want to speak, please indicate by waving or using the raise hand function at the bottom of your screen. So we are running a few people short of our quorum for voting items, but we'll continue with our agenda notwithstanding, and then hold any voting items until we have a full complement and a quorum to be able to vote on those items. So with that, I'll skip over the item two on our agenda, which is the to vote and approve the draft minutes from our March meeting. But apropos of my previous comment, we item three on our agenda is our membership update. Bruce, maybe you can kind of update the group again on what our status is with regard to appointments that we're waiting for.
I'll provide the beginning of an update and then pass it over to Martin, who might be able to say a little more about the governor's office process. But the group is currently with three vacancies. I believe nominations are now to the governor's office for all three. Mayor Hoydick of Stratford has been nominated to fill a position for CCM. First Selectman Chris of Harwinton, I believe, has just been nominated for the COST position. And Lyle Ray's chair in the group apparently will remain within CROG because Matt Hart has been nominated to fill that position. And maybe Martin has more to say.
Sure. Thanks, Bruce, and good morning, everybody. Yeah, I spoke with the governor's office last night with their staff. They are in process of going through the recommendations. They did say that they would be reaching out to the organizations that have submitted the recommendations, because a couple of them needed some further information for them to just complete their process through that they have to go through. But things are in process and they should be reaching out hopefully today from my conversations with them last night.
Great. Great. Thank you. Thanks to both you, Martin, and Bruce for writing herd on that. Also, just for the group's information, Bruce and I have been meaning to kind of get together. Bruce, I'm sorry that I have not been as following up with you on this as I should have been. You know, in terms of those identifying some members who have not been attending regularly, I think we do need to also address that issue. I plan on reaching out to those members who've been kind of spotty in terms of their attendance. We don't have any express rules necessarily regarding lack of attendance, meaning that you're off the commission. But, you know, I think we do need to kind of make sure that folks who are nominally on ACIR are attending and understand the responsibility to show up and be present. And to the extent folks are maybe not interested or have moved on, what have you, we would need to kind of clarify that with them so that we can either invite them to come back and be more part of this or resign so that we can fill their position with someone else. So that's a task for me to work out with Bruce as an administrative matter. So Bruce, I'll, you know, you can feel free to ping me about that again over the course of the next week or so, and I'll start reaching out to those folks. So item four on our agenda is the ACIR annual report with a target date of July. Bruce, can you update us again on that?
Yes, hang on just a moment. Yes, the annual report, the group decided last month that because the report does not have a deadline and includes an annual work plan that can be heavily influenced by legislative decisions, the group decided to have that be a summer thing rather than a winter or spring thing. So anticipate as we approach the end of the fiscal year, I will take what I've already done and add whatever additional work items are going into the flow, and I'll get that out perhaps at the June meeting. And it's a short session this year, so it can be adapted as necessary at that time. And I'll go right ahead and reference the mandates report. That's due well into the future, but a recurring topic going back a few years has been how the group might change its mandates reporting. It's obligated by statute to do certain types of reporting, but there are questions about the usability of that kind of approach. And I included a link just below that line on the agenda to a couple paragraph thing I assembled referencing your task force report of a couple years ago, and also noting some other ACIR discussion, in particular about selecting a sample of mandates and doing a deeper dive. You know, we all know that, say, Goshen and Hartford are likely to be affected very differently by a particular mandate. Hartford might have staff on hand that can handle it, you know, in the engineering department or whatever, whereas another town may not. Or it could go the other way, that the first selectman of a small town actually can answer something that the mayor of a big city couldn't hope to do without bringing in lots of staff. So that's a topic for discussion. It may not happen this year, but over the long haul, say, if the group thinks about it further and discusses it, maybe it's a change that could be rolled out next year. But that's what those are there for. I put them on there in part to let you know what's going on with reporting obligations, and partly to remind me that there are reporting obligations I don't want to overlook. And so if there are any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
I like the fact that you included on the agenda, Bruce, so that we can feature you and get you on screen with all of us at least once during the meeting. it gives us that opportunity.
I like to go back to my cave.
Well, before you do, are there any questions about that or thoughts on that? We do revisit this every month, just as a reminder to everyone, but there isn't a particular action item that is pressing at the moment. So thanks, Bruce, for that update. Okay, so if there aren't any questions on that, then let's move right into the item five on our agenda, which is the LGF subcommittee and initiative. We've had a fair amount of activity over the course of the last month at our first, if I could, let me actually skip to the bullet point that's a little bit under, which is the intergovernmental issues regarding the emergency management system. At our last, LGF subcommittee meeting, I believe it was on March 22nd, we were following up on the issue that Jim O'Leary had raised with us about the emergency management system in Connecticut. And we heard from the Deputy Commissioner Bergeron about how their emergency management planning has proceeded. We also were introduced to the new staff person who will be responsible for that at DESPE. And I don't know, Jim, if you want to just elaborate a little bit on what the outcome of that meeting was.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Brenda Bergeron, who is the deputy commissioner, basically the commissioner for the Division of Emergency Management, reported on, she gave a little summary of the importance of the National Incident Management System and how Connecticut is wedded to that program and how important it is. We also had a little discussion about John Filczek, I believe, brought up the discussion about our COVID resources page, and the commissioner was very interested in that and thought that there might be some future role that ACIR might play with the messaging from Demis in emergencies. She also talked about the state agency training and exercise plan, which was really the basis of my original concern. And she discussed how basically what had happened was that that plan was authorized and promulgated, you might say, about a month or two prior to the pandemic. And it never really, they never really had a chance to go through the training that the plan required due to the pandemic. And so she suggested that perhaps in a few months, she'd like to return and have a discussion about the progress that they might make on fulfilling the obligation of that plan, which actually is required by state statute. And so I think that's where we left it. She also seemed to want to, and I had a subsequent conversation with her where she seemed to want to engage with ACIR over some future issues, such as the one about, I think that John also raised, or maybe you did, Mr. Chairman, about the boundaries of you know, the various mishmash boundaries that the state has for services. So she was seemed to be interested in that.
Good. Yep. Yeah. Thanks, Jim, for that summary. I think it was helpful and productive because I think we were able to sort of share information about what each of us are doing here and how we might be able to collaborate in the future. Not necessarily having a particular agenda item for ACIR to assume as of right now, but maintain a communication line so that we could collaborate going forward. Yeah, John, you have your hand raised.
Thank you. I just got off a 911 meeting a little bit ago. I serve as chairman of that commission, and I just thought, since we're talking about emergency management, a couple key takeaways, and it may be wise that when that the 911 commission be invited in to that meeting to share their side, since they're all partners on sides, a strong word. It sounds like you're against each other, share their role. But a couple of things. William Turner has been appointed to replace Bill Hackett and in the role of emergency management. And Clayton Northgraves is now the in charge of the 911 system. He's been acting. So he started as a dispatcher in Hartford and went over to emergency to the state police system and has moved his way up. So they're trying to fill these vacancies and they're very qualified people. So, but I wanted to mention a couple things because on those agendas, we get upgrades, updates on everything from the 911 system to the public safety data network system to GIS mapping statewide. And they are planning a new flyover for next spring for mapping that will be covered in part by some ARPA money. So that's a good update. They're actually refreshing the whole public safety data network equipment. So a lot of good emergency management things are happening in the state that people just don't hear about. So I just wanted to share that brief update, and that there's a lot of really good happening on that. Those agencies all interact with all our local fire police departments. So it clearly just it's intergovernmental relations at its best and works quietly and silently, but it is working and improving to the point of they just first in the nation. They worked with the commuter trail system, and they have linked the commuter rail system, and they have linked the metro system to the state police radio network, so they can seamlessly go across state lines into New York and not lose communications. So it's the first mobile system where they're following the train routes and being able to pass over to the New York Police Department. So it's exciting. Very quietly done, no great cost, a lot of computer programming and hard work, but agencies are doing things that don't get any attention that have great significance to the public safety in our state.
Wow, that's fabulous. That's a great update. And to your point about intergovernmental relationships here, to the extent that we can be helpful, let us know. On that front. Great. Thanks, John. So, and Bruce, I think I'm seeing your attractive, I'm trying to be politically correct in how I describe this, but your kind face, let's put it that way, on the screen, which is, I think, alerting us to the fact that we do have a quorum.
That is right. And by having all this backlighting, no one can know if I'm attractive or not. So that works out well. I emailed a few people who had not joined yet, and several have joined over the last few minutes. You do have a quorum now.
Great. Okay. All right. Thank you, Bruce. So with that quick update, thank you all for joining the group. We have an item that we passed over on the agenda that we should get a vote on. And then the next item is also a voting item. So appreciate your participation. Let me go back to item 2 on our agenda, which is just the approval of the draft minutes of the March 4th meeting. Do I have a motion?
So moved.
Second.
Ron and John. As a second, any discussion? And if not, I'll try your minds. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, any abstentions? All right, thank you all. So those are deemed approved. So the next item on our, under item 5 on our agenda that I think also will require some a vote of the full group is the other piece of the LGF subcommittee's work, which started at the meeting on March 22nd, that started with Brenda Bergeron's presentation and discussion with us, but then We also had a conversation among the subcommittee about the future work of that subcommittee and what we might consider. John Filczek and Francis Pickering and I agreed that we would get together to kind of flesh that out a little bit more. And you have a link on your agenda to what we came up with. And essentially what we decided or are proposing is that the LGF subcommittee really focus on two particular areas that are somewhat interrelated, but really are very distinct kinds of discussions. And maybe rather than my dominating the discussion of it, I'll give a brief summary, but maybe I can ask John and or Francis to jump in to kind of flesh out the description. The first is with regard to municipal data collection, the fact that we are at the state level, we are collecting a lot of data. We are requesting towns and boards of ed to provide data, some of which is very helpful and useful. Some of it is not or has not been actually leveraged for the purposes that they were originally intended for. And there's also requests for data that are just not being fulfilled in many cases by towns and boards, specifically the Uniform Chart of Accounts accounting. So that's one area that we wanted to perhaps focus on as to that data collection element and what we may or may not be able to find out and recommend with regard to that. But then the second was an issue that I think we've talked about quite a lot in the past, which is the extent to which Connecticut, its towns and its regions are maximizing federal funds and bringing those funds back to Connecticut. To what degree are we successful or unsuccessful in that effort? But related to that, the discussion that Jim was mentioning that we had with Brenda Bergeron, which is the fact that we have this mishmash of catchment and service areas for different elements of providing services at the local and regional level, to the extent to which that is hampering our ability to maximize receipt of federal funds. And let me stop there, and I'll let John and or Francis kind of pick it up from there. I don't know who wants to maybe jump in. Maybe first on the data collection issue. John?
Thanks, Brendan.
Yeah, there you go.
My bandwidth is acting up today, so hopefully I'm audible. Yeah, we've looked at this. A lot of data has been collected for decades. It's not clear what it's being used for, if anything, in some cases. It's not just UCOA. It's not just is the data consistently being reported, but there is data being collected, such as municipal fiscal indicators on a consistent basis that appears not to being used to its full potential. There are other data sources, such as the CAFRs, the audit reports, that the data is consistent, but the reporting, the structure is not. There's really a lot of data that could be leveraged to better inform policymaking in the state of Connecticut. And I think the first thing we need to do is inventory what's being collected, then determine how it's being used, and then look at, are there things we can do with this data? Do we need to tweak the data that we're requesting or how it's being reported? And go there.
Right. Thank you. That's a good succinct summary of that. John, do you want to talk about the other piece of that too?
I would urge everyone to take a look at this new study from the Rockefeller Institute and their, which was done for New York, but it also covers all 50 states. And Connecticut jumps out as, for the most part, coming in dead last in terms of its leveraging of federal funds. And part of what we're looking at is, okay, why is that the case? What could we be doing differently to bring in more of those dollars? You know, what are counties and other states doing that works? Obviously, we don't have counties, but is there a way that we could use the COGS and the RESCs to better leverage those funds, or the state in general. And one of our ideas is to perhaps invite in some different counties from their grant offices and say, you know, what do you do? Why? What are the reasons that Connecticut is just where it is, you know, nationally? And it's been, and if you look at that data, it goes back, I think, to 2015, pretty consistent, not doing a good job.
Right.
There's got to be reasons for it. And I don't know what they are, but something to explore.
Yeah. And I think the, if I, I know there are a couple of hands raised. Let me just say, I think in both cases, these are things that I know, you know, I know in my experience, we've been talking about for literally decades about the extent to which Connecticut is not well informed, basically, in terms of what it's doing and why it's doing it and how that is directing policy on how to go forward with regard to not just municipal issues, property tax relief, other things, but also, you know, questions of equity in how we develop policies and apply policies statewide. So just having, you know, I think conducting that type of inventory and assessment on both fronts is a little bit of backfilling on stuff that I think we probably should have been doing in the past, but perhaps just haven't had the time or the bandwidth to do. And I think it's probably time to do that, given that we are kind of moving into a different, I think, a different world with regard to the future of local government and regional government in Connecticut. So I would also just add that I think Francis and John and I were also in agreement that, you know, these are the kinds of analyses that lend themselves well to the work with the with UConn, to the extent that University of Georgia is still interested, but having, you know, getting some help from intern resources or grad student kind of resources, the research is something that, that could actually be accomplished by, you know, a partnership with academic institutions that have already expressed an interest in doing this kind of thing. And I think it might really help relieve the burden on all of us individually in terms of having to culminate and accumulate this information and then leave it to our group to actually be able to flesh out the details of how we might want to go forward with that. So I have some other thoughts, but let me stop there. Jim, I think you had your hand raised.
Yes, thank you. So I just wanted to wonder, you know, I'm disappointed that, that Lyle isn't with us, because I think Lyle could perhaps shed some light on this. You know, from my point of view, I think CROG is probably best positioned in the state to be in the forefront. You know, I don't know, John, maybe John Filchek, maybe I'm wrong, but it seems like they have staffed up and they've been attempting to perhaps ferret out more grants than, you know, I know, for example, more grants than our local COG is working on. And so I'm wondering what their issues are, if they are somehow limited in their expanse at gaining access to these grants because they're just one COG. Does it have to be a statewide organized effort, or is it just that they haven't had the bandwidth, so to speak, to go after everything?
Yeah, let me take a quick stab at that, Jim. I think our the frame within which we were viewing this was that really no individual COG or REST really has the kind of we assume, actually, we're making an assumption here, that our COGs and RESTs don't really have the bandwidth themselves individually to seek out, apply for, and administer the kinds of grants that and other funding that is available at the federal level in the same way that county governments, for example, in other states do that, right? There is a reason why county government is designed in particular to, you know, or is best designed, at least from a Washington standpoint, to receive these funds and disseminate them locally. And, you know, I think that's part of our interest in digging into this. You know, what do counties, successful counties of similar size to our counties or our RESC areas or COG areas, how do they do it? How much staff do they need? What are their resources that they actually can deploy along these lines? And how might we replicate that here in Connecticut? I think so. I'm not sure it's necessarily up to one particular COG over another. I think it's more to analyze what do our COGs have, need, you know, how best can they and their REST counterparts leverage these funds? I think that's really where we're going. John, before I get to you, let me just ask John Elsesser.
Thank you. While counties are in a significant role, I want to just say the COGs also have been on a roller coaster of state aid. It's there and then it's taken away. So hiring staff is at risk. So we have to understand that the state funding of COGs is jeopardizing their capabilities and capacities to go after some of these long-term grants. Secondly, the state itself is last. Is there a state department that is geared to getting federal grants? And the answer is no. It's delegated to the different agencies who also now are going through major staffing issues. A federal grant person has to have a certain skill set. These are not, you go after in 2 seconds and put together an application. They're long-term. You have to follow things. Sometimes you have to nurture programs to get in alignment. So it can be a multi-year process of getting ready. And the state of Connecticut fails miserably. So I think the study is important, but it's not just the county issues. While that's significant,
yeah.
We've made some headway, thank God, with the ARPA money that we got county money into the state that we also would have lost as we have other programs. But I think we have to understand it's not just the COGS, and part of the COGS capabilities are lack of a reliable funding source in the state.
Right. Agreed. Francis, I'm sorry, John. John Filczek, I'll get you too. Sorry.
Oh, yes. Thank you, Brendan. What I was going to respond to Jim and essentially say is that it's not a question of really the COGS here or not as a structure. It's do we have the resources we need to apply to federal grants? Grants come out from a variety of departments throughout the year. You really need to have a dedicated unit, in my view, that looks at forthcoming federal grant opportunities, formulates a game plan, lines up the required matching funds, gets the buy-in, really proactive, forward-looking, rather than what happens in Connecticut, which is largely we hear about a funding opportunity and we send it out and say, anybody have ideas? Most of the COG staff, we don't, at least at West COG, we are the second most populous COG in the state, we don't have a dedicated grant writing unit. The grants are an add-on for the work that our staff already have. So I think it's much more about having strategic capacity and organizational capacity than it is what the COGS or the state currently are doing.
Right. John Filczek.
I'll just add a couple of things. I mean, and pick up on what Francis was saying, we're the smallest COG in terms of population with 96,000 folks. So we're basically a tenth of what CROG and West COG are with their roughly million residents. And I have small towns. I also have a full-time dedicated grants person for our towns and for our region. But one of the challenges that we run into, and ARPA thankfully was the thing that kind of hopefully is a model they'll keep using, where we did have some the feds giving us county money to the state is I can recall a review of a Brownfields application we had, and one of the we didn't get it, and one of the and we asked for a post review of it, and I had a person from Alaska saying, you know, what's a cock? And you know, we're not all known when you get beyond our boundaries of why do you just have why are there no counties in Connecticut? So we do suffer from that, and internally, I think we still suffer from the mentality is we're going to feed the 169 towns. We're going to feed the 79 state agencies individually and all those fractured regions. And I think that's a big reason for the lack of success in the leveraging of federal monies is just that I go back to that fractured nature of Connecticut again and again.
I think that is clearly, I mean, the subtext.
You know, when we look at economic development as an example, we tend to focus on the town, not on the region, a group of multi towns where there's direct and indirect impacts. We talk about, we're going to locate it in town X. And what are we going to do for town X in terms of economic development dollars, et cetera. It's very rare that we look at a multi-town or a regional impact in terms of economic development as an example. And for a state this small, that makes no sense.
Right. I agree. And I'm sorry to have interrupted you there. I think that is going to be, I'm sure, a subcategory of this, which is, you know, to what extent is the fractured and kind of crazy quilt of different service delivery areas hampering our ability to leverage these kinds of funds. So I think we'll be that will definitely be part of what we go into with this. I think we kind of have fleshed out the question about data collection and how we go about doing that. Let me just say here too that there is a lot of work that we're going to be taking on post session, because one of the other things that we had talked about as a group is that we want to make ourselves available and perhaps even take on ourselves some questions and issues related to property taxes. We have reached out to Commissioner Boughton to make ourselves available for him if there are some areas that he'd like to investigate for the next biennium to introduce in 2023 regarding how we do property taxes here in Connecticut. The specific nature of that is yet to be defined, probably won't come out, or we won't be able to define it until after the session is over. But, you know, we want to make some room or maintain some room on our own personal agenda for that potential. And then the other piece I would just want to add for everyone is that we have already been identified in legislation as a resource to study a completely different element of local state relationships, which is the question of how we do local meeting notices and what in the modern world is the appropriate way to notice decision making at the local level. Traditionally been done in the newspaper, in print, but with the decline of the traditional print media, that is on the wane, and what could be a surrogate for that going forward. There is legislation that's already passed out of planning and development that designates ACIR as the source for conducting that type of study to report back in January. So those are, you know, those are a few, actually now four things potentially that we would be taking on between now and the end of the calendar year. You know, I'm ready to roll up my sleeves and go all in on that. But I think we all also as a group need to be aware of what we're taking on as our responsibilities. Yeah, Jim.
As I've just been listening to the beginning conversation about the counties versus the COGS, and I know we're at the very, very, very beginning of that kind of discussion and dive into that, but it seems right at the outset that I guess we're going to have to figure out somewhere down the road, is the real option going back to a county government, or is the option open that we could actually use the COGS or several combined COGS as a substitute for county government? And so I think we need to, before we go a long ways to try to, my preference would be to roll this into the COGS. In Region 5 out here, we have three COGS in Region 5, which, you know, sort of roughly represents Litchfield County. I could see where those three COGS could be rolled into basically a county-like government, and they could share responsibilities for services. But if that's not a structure that would be workable in the federal landscape, I guess we ought to know that right up front so that we wouldn't spend a lot of time thinking about that.
Right. I think that's the purpose of the study. Right. I think it would be premature to, you know, presume what a recommendation could be for the future maximization of federal grants, for example. I think we don't want to predetermine what that outcome would be. I think studying it and making a recommendation based upon our analysis is really where we would want to go. That's my own sense. John, do you have a comment on that?
I guess what my comment would be that, and maybe this is a reflection of being around in this business for 28 years, we have had this discussion about counties, COGS, and I think it's settled.
I agree.
Connecticut has never had county government, in a very minor form. It's not that, you know, we dissolved this great county system in 1960. It barely did a thing. And the politics of that going backwards. And I think when we went through when you were Speaker, Mr. Chairman, you recall when we made the move to go to COGS from the 15 regions, and it's a shame that that's not really captured in a nice document we could brief everybody on. That was pretty much settled. This is where we're going, is the COG form with, we had more debate whether it was going to be five COGS or eight COGS. We ended up with nine for other reasons, but I think the COG format is the format that has evolved to this point. And I think politically, to go down that rabbit hole of let's bring back counties will get us off on a tangent that we won't make a lot of progress, in my view.
Yeah, agreed.
I agree.
Yeah.
So that brings me to that question again of how does this fit with the federal landscape? Maybe we need to, this is premature discussion, I guess, but maybe we need to be talking to our federal representatives to bring them in and have them ferret out whether this is an option and how would it work.
Right. Agreed. Right. That would be the purpose of this study, to open these things up for all that conversation. Right. Matt, welcome. And
Thank you so much, Mr. Chairman. Matt Hart, the new executive director for Capital Region.
Yes. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm very happy to be here. And for those of you who I don't know, I've worked in local government in Connecticut for a good long while. And I've been associated with CROG for about 10 years now. Most recently, I was the town manager in West Hartford. And I'm also an adjunct professor with UConn's now School of Public Policy. That was great news to get yesterday. But just building on John Filczak's point, you know, what he was talking about just a moment or two ago, I think what I'm learning and what some of the COGs have been doing successfully for some years now, there are direct services that we can provide to our member towns. You know, we can even employ folks at the COG level who can work in our member community. So there's a lot we can do in that regard. I know at CROG, we are looking to expand our portfolio in that regard. So I don't think we necessarily need to jump to the county level in order to accomplish that goal. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Matt. Right. Francis, whatever it is that you're putting your jelly on looks particularly good. I'm starting to salivate a little bit.
Well, thanks, Brandon. It's toast. That's all I have is my kitchen's being redone. And I have no heat or hot water. So it's a bit of a mess right now. But what I was going to say is I think it's a little bit easy to become distracted by lines on a map and think about kind of the big picture organizational structure. But what we really are talking about here is operations and capacity. So it's not important whether a COG or a county or a major city in a metro area applies for the federal money for the grants. What's important is that they get everybody talking together, that they have the resources to have the awareness of the grants, to be able to put together consensus-driven competitive applications that actually are awarded. And that takes having grant management, grant application expertise, and also to be able to implement the grants. These are not trivial tasks. Reporting on a loan of federal grants can be quite daunting. And what we tend to do in Connecticut is we miss out on many grants. When we do apply for them, our applications may not be competitive. And then the administrative costs of managing a federal grant for an entity that rarely receives them, perhaps has never received one, it's a very steep learning curve. If you have a unit of people which is all they do is apply to manage and report on federal grants, then it's administratively much more efficient. So I think focusing on the boundaries is not as important as focusing on the horsepower there.
Right. Thank you. Agreed. John?
I would second what Francis just said, but I also want to just respond to one thing, because I think it's a perception that folks have about the COGS that is incorrect, where I have to deal with this, I guess, on an ongoing basis, where, well, you just have 16 towns and 96,000 people, you're pretty small. And we are in terms of towns and population. But we have a very broad portfolio of programs and currently employ 42 people. Because our towns are small and they don't have a lot of capacity. So we've been able to grow programs to service those towns. That's our model. It's not every COGS model to do that. So there are COGS with 7 or 8 staff people servicing close to 1 million people. So it does vary from COG to COG. And I wouldn't, for anyone listening in or here, make any assumption based on population or number of towns as to what exactly they may be doing. They're all the choice of the respective chief elected officials for that particular COG. And what you find, my observation has been many of the larger communities and wealthier communities have internal capacity where some of the things that we may provide in a rural COG are not needed. And I look to the Franklin County COG in Massachusetts, which I believe to me is probably one of the best COGs that I know of nationally. They service one of the most rural regions in Massachusetts with an amazing portfolio of services. Maybe we have to have some briefing on what exactly COGs do, but I wouldn't make too much assumptions just based on number of towns or population. On their face, it doesn't really tell the story.
Right. Right. Good. Okay. Well, I think the conversation has been enlightening and helpful. I think what we should do formally, though, is vote on these two topics for the LGF subcommittee to take on, keeping in mind that there are going to be some other tasks that I think we're going to be taking on as well. But I guess we should go ahead and do a vote and proceed accordingly. So could I get a motion to take on these two topics through the subcommittee?
Yes, Francis makes a motion.
Francis, second.
Second
from John. Is there any other discussion on this? Okay, if not, I'll try your minds. All those in favor, please indicate by saying aye. Saying aye.
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 Any opposed? Speak up. Shoot your camera on. Let us know. Wave your hands. Pound the table. Or any abstentions. Okay, thank you. Thank you all. We'll proceed accordingly. I think we've covered the rest of the items on the bullets on item 5 on our agenda. So let's move to other old business. I think I talked about sub A on item 6, which is the potential ACIR assignments in the 2022 legislation. What has not passed the legislature yet, but has been JF'd out of planning and development, which is the study of public notices and how best to handle that. I don't know. I don't think there's anything else that popped on my radar that we should be aware of that may have been. I don't know, Martin, do you have any further insight on that?
Sure. No, I think, thanks, Brandon. The one you mentioned of the legal notice is 5359, is a work group. It's not solely ACIR, but ACIR is involved in it. So that's a working group. That was kind of a modification to do that way. And I think ACIR, by the language, appoints the chair, but then there's certain members bringing all the parties together to look at that. So it's much better than one agency looking at it. A couple of the others, I think, out there I think that's the only one ACIR has mentioned in that I'm aware of, I think, out of the JFS languages that came out. Some of the others were reverted over to their proper, administrating agencies. So I think that's good. And I think the other one was on the Title VII, but I think that's a work group as well. Or I'm trying to remember if the Title VII was a work group or if it was solely ACIR.
Yeah.
And I don't remember what the bill number is offhand because I can look it up.
Yeah, right. I know we've talked about this. Our individual members have talked about the need to kind of completely revamp Title VII in the general statutes to bring it up to date and up to speed. But I wasn't, has that been expressly codified in a JFS?
I'm going through my bills because I don't have them in an order. I mean, they're all by number order, so I'm trying to find out which one
is. Come on, man, let's go.
I will look it up, and if you continue on, I'll get back to you momentarily. But because that one did, I think, go through, and I can't remember if it went to ACIR, if it went to a larger group. We also, I know, discussed that it needed more time than 1 year to be able to do, which I know co-chair McCarthy Vahey was in agreement with. So let me look that one up.
Yeah. Okay. That's great. So I know that we also, under old business, this is normally Lyle's point on the agenda to talk about the UGA and UConn studies. So I don't know if anyone else has an update on the status of those graduate reports and when they expect to be presented. If not, we can invite. Oh yeah, Matt.
I don't have an update, but I'll be happy to get one shortly.
Great. Okay. And then. We also have on the agenda 6C, which is the infrastructure funding and the governor's recommendations regarding ARPA. You know, we've made recommendations regarding to the governor about additional staffing at OPM in part to assist ACIR's ability to do the kinds of things that folks are inclined to want to do. Probably not going to happen in this second year of the biennium, but we are kind of planting a flag, hopefully for consideration in the next biennium for discussion in the next budget starting in 2023 legislative session. So, and Martin, I think you may have an update for us. You're muted, sorry.
Thank you. That's because I was trying to look at two screens and be able to tell you. So the task force to study Title VII, which is proposed substitute Bill 324, that one they switched over from OPM doing it to a task force. And some of that is in there. There is representation of ACIR plus a whole list of, you know, eight other, you know, members. So they've done it more as a task force, which is a better approach to this. So, but ACIR would be represented on that.
Great. Well, and so to the extent that members of ACIR are interested in participating, you know, please let Bruce or me know that, you know, that you might have an interest in jumping in on that. Oops. I'm sorry. There we go. You know, please let Bruce or I know if you might be interested in participating on that. We'll know better once the legislation actually passes. But you know, think about it in the meantime and let us know if there's a, if you have a particular interest and you know, you can represent the group. I'm not sure, you know, as chairman, I necessarily want to be jumping onto every task force that we're identified in, given my limited bandwidth, but, you know, I will if I need to, but obviously if other folks are interested in the topic, we should, you know, please let us know. Let's see, there was other new business, which I know there was another thing that I wanted to mention to the group. And I'm kind of, I'm forgetting what it was. Yeah, Bruce, I'm sorry.
I don't know if this will be what you had in mind, but referring back to the UConn and UGA studies, Eric Ziemering, the public policy department guy from University of Georgia, who was working with the ACIR on some of the studies, has extended an invitation to ACIR members to prepare a, I forget how he referred to it, but an insight essay for a journal, an academic journal that he's a co-editor of. And if anyone might be interested, you're not committing by doing this, but if you might be interested in participating in that, it would be a fairly short-term thing to come up with a couple-page essay. If you're interested, shoot me an email. I've heard from a couple members who might be interested but are in a time crunch. So it may be that the ACIR has to, you know, say you don't have the time for it. But if there's time, it would might be an interesting thing.
What is their deadline, do you think, for submission?
I would have to go back and check. It looked like it was something that would have to be relatively ready to go within the next month or so. So it's not that it has to be due. It's not due by the end of today, but you don't have 6 months.
Right. Good. That's a nice broad scale. Okay. Yes. not today, but not 6 months either. So, okay. Again, if there are folks who are interested in drafting that, I it would be an interesting thing. I also might be interested in helping out with that. So maybe we can, but Bruce, maybe we, you and I can connect at some point in the next couple of weeks to see who else has expressed some interest in doing that. Okay. So let's see. Under, it was something else under new business, and I'm blanking a little bit. There was a, I know that one thing too, and this is a, an administrative item that I just wanted to alert Bruce to. We had voted at a previous, I think last meeting, to send a letter of support to the CAPS blueprint. And I've been waiting to hear from the lobbyist who is working for CAPS to kind of connect with us to kind of make sure that we've got the right language in that. I saw that, I don't think we're, it's a busy time. So folks are, you know, with the session, but I don't think CAPS is back on with us, but I know, I see Sheila's here, but not, not our, our CAPS folks. So, you know, I'm going to, I'll be sending out a letter on over our, under on our letterhead in support of that, but I'm still waiting to connect up and make sure that we've got our language prepared. Other than that, I think we're pretty set. Are there any other thoughts or comments from the group that we should be mindful of going forward? We're by the next time we meet will be Friday, May 6th. So that will be after the end of the legislative session. So if there's anything that we need to be mindful of going forward between now and our next meeting with regard to the legislative session, now would be the time. if you want us to be flagging things or watching things other than the stuff that we've already talked about. Are there any thoughts about that? Or yes, first Jim and then Margaret.
Okay, this is just a thought. John Filczek, it's my understanding that Rita has moved to from the Dems grant section. She was the very effective grants writer and manager for must be close to 20 years there, but she's moved over to UConn to be, I think, doing their grants writing. And so I'm wondering, since you know her, if you could reach out to her and see if there's any guidance or information or anything, any thoughts that she would have relevant to our conversation about how we get more bandwidth to the COGS, you might say. I don't know if she would have some insights. She's been really great at doing this grants writing, I know. Just a thought.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. And Margaret?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I certainly hope that they pass something having to do with the remote meetings and all that. But we won't know till it's over, right?
Thank you, Margaret. That was the thing I wanted to talk about. Yeah, and I was hoping someone in the group. Yeah, thank you very much, Margaret, because that was front of mind, and I brought it up at the beginning of the meeting, and then I lost it again. Does anyone have in? I mean, Ron, maybe you do. Insight as to why the remote meeting thing has taken on a partisan tone.
That's what I was going to bring up. All these great minds think alike, because that was the issue I was going to bring up. We're trying to find out what's going on, why it's having difficulty getting out of P&D. We're trying to meeting with people to try to find out what the problem is, because there's a somewhat sense of urgency about it to try to get the bill done and passed by mid-April. So we're still trying to figure it out, basically. But I just wanted to alert people to the fact that there is a problem. Some legislators are having a problem with it, and so it's not quite a done deal yet.
Yeah, Ron, I mentioned at the beginning of the meeting, it may have been before you jumped on, that I have been, well, Chairman McCarthy of AE has been in touch with me, particularly ahead of the GAE vote this week. And she asked specifically if I could provide her with the raw data results of our survey to, you know, as so that she could use that, you know, as in the debate over the bill, which I did, and she appreciated. Thanks again, Bruce, for, you know, having that available in a Excel spreadsheet that was easily transferred. But I then tried to watch the GAE meeting to follow what the discussion was. And unfortunately, GAE in particular just pops around, was jumping from, you know, item one to item 20 and then back to item seven. And it was impossible to, unless you watch the entire 5 hours of the meeting, it was really impossible to figure out or find the spot of the meeting that where this was being discussed. So, you know, I plan on reaching out to Kristen for some guidance on what this is happening, but certainly, you know, to the extent, and I didn't even know that GAE had its own bill that was related to this. So if there's, I'm going to reach out to the House chairs anyway, as well as the Senate chairs, to offer our help on this, if there's any confusion or, but I just can't imagine why any legislator who cares about their constituents at the local level would ignore a 90% approval rate for remote meetings. I mean, I it seems like politically that just doesn't make any sense.
Right. I mean, when you get some additional information, yeah, I'd love to get it. And when I when CCM gets additional information, we'll share it with you. We hope to be able to give you information by Tuesday. Yeah, it's been a mystery to us too, and unexpected.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So let's stay in touch. I'm happy to weigh in or meet with anyone on behalf of ACIR to kind of clarify things if that's needed.
I appreciate that. We will take you up on that likely. Yes.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Yeah. Yeah. John, you've had your hand raised.
Yeah. I was going to mention some other bills, but I'll just mention to this what you were just talking about. I have had a discussion with one lawmaker who, and maybe I don't know if this is the cause of the hang up, but about the possibility or the desire to have added to the bill for certain boards, commissions for the larger or the more senior ones, like planning, like a board of selectmen, town council, and planning and zoning, make the remote aspect not an option but mandatory going forward. And I don't know if that's what's causing this, but I know that's a discussion going on behind the scenes.
I'm sorry, having the remote meeting, have it be entirely remote?
That meeting, it cannot be just in person. That it would, you know, it's not an option. You have to broadcast those certain number. You have to broadcast those meetings.
Okay.
Yeah.
It has to do both. Which is,
but again, the way the legislation is drafted, I think they intentionally drafted this to be, at least the P&D version, is to leave it as a local option.
Right.
And
that's pretty much what the GAE bill says, except it kills it at, on December 31st, which would effectively kill it for the winter.
Right. And that is a disaster. And
it's a bad thing.
Right. Right.
There are four bills that I think relate to our earlier discussion of finance, revenue, and bonding. Senate 380, 381, and House 5406 and 5407, which deal with they're all studies of both state tax policies and state revenue and fiscal policies. And I'm going to guess that they'll, at some point, if they go forward, they'll all get merged into one big sort of, you know, Connecticut state tax panel part two. So John, you can get onto that one. And have another report that hopefully doesn't sit on the shelf, but I think it bears watching, along with the tax incidents legislation that's going forward to broaden what the future tax incidence studies will be from what was just produced.
Right, right. Yeah, thanks for that. I think for, excuse me, I think for sure, you know, we've got a commissioner of DRS who, you know, is a strong supporter of everything ACIR is doing. And is a strong supporter of data, of COGS, of efficiencies, of property tax reform. I mean, he gets it in ways that I think others may not. So I know it to the extent that he is fully supportive of the kinds of things we've been looking into. He will be an ally and somebody we definitely want to continue to work with, regardless of what the legislation comes out. Okay. So thank you all. Are there any other comments? Yes, Jim, you need to unmute.
Just quickly, do you think you have, once you get the information regarding the problems with the remote bill, do you think you might want to have a special meeting of ACIR if we need to weigh in and actually enforce or emphasize a statement regarding how that works one way or another?
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I think that's a great question, you know, to the extent that ACIR is, there's a fine line, I guess, to a certain degree, in my mind, you know, should ACIR be an advocate for a particular outcome, or were we asked to report and make a recommendation and leave it at that, right? So I'm not sure that, you know, if we were to have a meeting like that, if we'd want to be getting then engaging in a lobbying effort, basically, or even, I mean, certainly providing information and being a resource is one thing, which I'm happy to do. I think if we step over the line towards saying, hey, guys, you know, wake up, this is something we've got to do, that may be a role that ACIR should be careful about treading in. So that would be my only hesitation. Happy to provide updates to folks. Not sure that we should be, you know, mobilizing to advocate. If that's okay. What your thought was on that, Jim.
Yeah, in the past, ACIR has certainly taken the position that it wanted to advocate and mobilize the legislature, particularly when we had members of the legislature actually attending the ACIR meetings. So over the years, there have been definite times when we advocated.
Yeah, okay, that's fair. I mean, obviously, we're also weighing in on the CAPS blueprint. So, you know, and making an advocacy statement along those lines. So I think that's fair. And to the extent that there's, I mean, certainly we would want to not go with the GAE version of ending the remote meetings on December 31st. We know from our own study, that's a disaster. So, yeah, I hear your point. And maybe if it appears that there's some misinformation out there, or if there's a role that we can play in encouraging and advocating, we can maybe pull a special meeting together. It's a good idea. Let's kind of see how this plays out over the next week or so, and then we can make that decision, if that's okay with you.
Sure, that sounds like a good plan.
Okay, good. Thanks for that, Jim. Yeah. All right. Any other thoughts or comments before we adjourn? Okay, seeing none. Oh, John. Oh, is that an April Fool's joke, John, or is that a... Yeah, okay, got it, right. Okay, so no April Fool's jokes today. I'll take a motion to adjourn. Martin and Jim as a second. Great, thank you. All those in favor, aye.
Aye.
Okay. We will stand adjourned. Our next meeting will be of the subcommittee will be on April 26th. If you want to mark your calendars, because that's something that we will, where we'll be taking up the items that we voted on today for sure. And then our next meeting of the full ACIR is Friday, May 6th after session is over. So look forward to the opening of opening day. Go Yankees. But otherwise, have a great weekend, everybody, and we'll be in touch over the course of the next few weeks. Take care.